in an evening, and I must say that I haven't actually timed this whole thing all the way through, timed parts of it, so I'm not sure just how long we may be here, or some of us, anyway. I have already decided that I'd better forego reading the selection from Flight Jacket as much as I would like to read that. So that is on the program, and it won't be read. From one of the my most favorite works in the 20th century, John Dos Passos' Trilogy USA, there's a statement that I'd like to use to kind of preface the reading to the authors that I've selected. And it goes, USA is a slice of a continent. USA is a group of holding companies, some aggregation unions, a set of laws bound in cast, a radio network, a chain of moving picture theaters, a column of stock quotations rubbed out and written in by a Western Union boy on a blackboard, a public library full of old newspapers and dog-eared history books with protests scrawled on the margins in pencil. USA is the world's greatest river valley, fringed with mountains and hills. USA is a set of big-mouthed officials with too many bank accounts. USA is a lot of men buried in their uniforms in Arlington Cemetery. USA is the letters at the end of an address when you are away from home. But mostly, USA is the speech of the people. It is in a mother's words telling about long ago, in a father's telling about when I was a boy, in the kidding stories of uncles, in the lies the kids told at schools, in the workmen's yarns, the tall tales told after taps and barracks. It is the speech that clings to the ears, that tingles in the blood, USA. And that's pretty much the way I feel about my country. As Shaw said in one of his plays, they haven't spoken English over there for about two centuries. And I think that the authors that I want to read here are writing and speaking in an American speech, the words, some of which, most of which we share with Great Britain, but this is the language of our country, and despite all the Anglophilic instruction at university levels in this country, we do have a literature worth listening to, I think. First thing I want to read from is the sketchbook of Geoffrey Tran, as it was called by Washington Irving. This was written about 150 years ago, and it tells about how he felt as an American toward Europe. And I don't know how you may receive this, but it seems to me to be still pretty accurate. Never need an American go beyond his own country for the sublime and beautiful of natural scenery, but Europe held forth the charms of storied and poetical associations. There were to be seen the masterpieces of art, the refinements of highly cultivated society, the quaint peculiarities of ancient and local customs. My native country was full of youthful promise. Europe was rich in the accumulated treasures of age. Her very ruins told the history of times gone by, and every moldering stone was a chronicle. I longed to wander over the scenes of renowned achievement, to tread, as it were, in the footsteps of antiquity, to loiter about the ruined castle, to meditate on the fallen tower, to escape, in short, from the commonplace realities of the present and lose myself among the shadowy grandeurs of the past. None but those who have experienced it can form an idea of the delicious throng of sensations which rush into an American when he first comes in sight of Europe. There is a volume of associations with the very name. It is the land of promise, teeming with everything with which his childhood has heard or on which his studious years have pondered. To an American visiting Europe, the long voyage he has to make is an excellent preparative. The temporary absence of worldly scenes and employments produces a state of mind peculiarly fitted to receive new and vivid impressions. The vast space of waters that separates the hemispheres is like a blank page in existence. There is no gradual transition by which, as in Europe, the features and population of one country blend almost imperceptibly with those of another. From the moment you lose sight of the land you have left, all is vacancy until you step on the opposite shore and are launched at once into the hustle and novelties of another world. The Selection that comes next by James is also about how an American who, like Irving, was an expatriate, felt some years later, I think the date of the American, the novel that comes from, is 1876, something like that, how he felt about meeting a fat duchess in Paris in 1876. Now, he's you need to know a little bit about the scene here. His name is Newman, the American. He's just become engaged to a very high-born French woman, young woman, whom he loves very, very much, called Madame de Cintra, who had been married once before. And her brother, Monsieur de Bellegarde, as he is referred to in this passage, and also the Marquis, as he's also referred to, is introducing Newman at a coming-out party for the American. Newman found himself in the presence of a lady of monstrous proportions, seated in a very capacious armchair, with several persons standing in a semicircle round her. This little group had divided as the Marquis came up, and Monsieur de Bellegarde stepped forward and stood for an instant, silent and obsequious, with the brim of his hat raised to his lips, as Newman had seen some gentlemen stand in churches as they entered their pews. The lady, indeed, bore a very fair likeness to a reverend effigy of some idolatrous shrine. She was monumentally stout and imperturbably serene. Her aspect was, to Newman, almost formidable. He had a troubled consciousness of a triple chin, a small piercing eye, a vast expanse of uncovered bosom, a nodding and twinkling tiara of plumes and gems, and an immense circumference of satin petticoat. With her little circle of beholders, this remarkable woman reminded him of the fat lady at a fair. She fixed her small, unwinking eyes at the newcomers. "Dear Duchess," said the Marquis, "let me present you our good friend, Mr. Newman, of whom you have heard us speak. Wishing to make Mr. Newman known to those who are dear to us, I could not possibly fail to begin with you."
"Charmed, dear friend, charmed, monsieur," said the Duchess,
while Newman executed his obeisance.
"I came on purpose to see monsieur. I hope he appreciates the compliment. You have only to look at me to do so, sir,"
he continued, sweeping her person with a much encompassing glance.
Newman hardly knew what to say, though it seemed to him that a duchess who joked about her corpulence, one might say anything. On hearing that the duchess had come on purpose to see Newman, the gentleman who surrounded her turned a little and looked at him with sympathetic curiosity. The Marquis, with supernatural gravity, mentioned to him the name of each, while the gentleman who bore that name bowed. They were all what are called in France bonhommes.
I wanted extremely to meet you," the duchess went on. "Positif. In the first place, I am very fond of the person you are going to marry. She is the most charming creature in France. Mind you treat her well, or you shall hear some news from me. But you look as if you were good. I am told you are very remarkable. I have heard all sorts of extraordinary things about you. Voyons, are they true?"
"I don't know what you have heard," said Newman.
"Oh, you have your legends. We have heard that you have had quite a career, the most checkered, the most bizarre. What is that about your having founded a city some 10 years ago in the Great West, a city that contains today 500,000 of inhabitants? Isn't it 500,000, monsieur? You are exclusive proprietor of this flourishing settlement and are consequently fabulously rich, and you would be richer still if you didn't grant lands and houses free to those who promise not to smoke cigars for 10 years. At this game, in 3 years, you are going to be made President of the United States."
The Duchess recited this amazing legend with a smooth self-possession which gave a speech to Newman's mind, the air of being an amusing dialogue in a play delivered by a veteran comic actress. Before she had ceased speaking, he had burst into loud, irrepressible laughter.
Dear Duchess, the Marquis began to murmur soothingly.
Two or three persons came to the door of the room to see who was laughing at the Duchess. But the lady continued with the soft, serene assurance of a person who, as a Duchess, was certain of being listened to, and as a garrulous woman, very independent of the pulse of her oddity. But I know you are very remarkable. You must be, to have endeared yourself to this good Marquis and his admirable mother. They don't bestow their esteem in all the world. They are very exacting. I myself am not very sure at this hour of really possessing it. Hey, Belga, to please you, I see one must be an engineer. But your real science, my dear sir, is pleasing the Countess. She is as difficult as a princess in a fairy tale. Your success is a miracle. What is the secret? I don't ask you to reveal it before all these gentlemen, but come and see me someday and give me a specimen of your talent. The secret is with Madame de Cintra, said Newman. You must ask her for it. It consists in her having a great deal of charity. Very pretty, said the Duchess. That is a very nice specimen to begin with. What, Delga, are you taking Monsieur away already? I have a duty to perform, dear friend, said the Marquis, pointing to the other groups. Ah, for you, I know what that means. Well, they don't want him to marry Monsieur. Well, I have seen Monsieur. That is what I wanted. He can't persuade me that he isn't very clever. However, as Newman passed on with his host, he asked who the Duchess was. The greatest lady in France, said the Marquis. My Romanian grand dame accent is the same as my French grand dame accent, my Czech and my British and the whole works. The next one concerns also, in a sense, traveling, a trip. This time a trip in the mind. It's from Walden by Henry David Thoreau. In the winter of 46-7, 100 Irishmen with Yankee overseers came from Cambridge to Walden to get out the ice. They divided into cakes by methods too well known to require description, and these, being sledded to the shore, were rapidly hauled off onto an ice platform and raised by grappling irons and block and tackle workers onto a stack, as surely as so many barrels of flour, and there placed evenly side by side and row upon row, as if they formed the solid base of an obelisk designed to pierce the clouds. They told me that in a good day they could get out 1,000 tons, which was the yield of about 1 acre. Thus, for 16 days, I saw from my window 100 men at work like busy husbandmen with teams and horses and apparently all the implements of farming, such a picture as we see in the first page of the almanac. And now they are all gone, and in 30 days more, probably, I shall look out from my window on the pure sea-green Walden water there, reflecting the clouds and the trees and sending up its evaporations and solitude, and no traces will appear that a man has ever stood there. Perhaps I shall hear a solitary loon laugh as he dies and cleans himself, or shall see a lonely fisher in his boat like a floating leaf, beholding his form reflected where lately 100 men labored securely. Thus it appears that the sweltering inhabitants of Charleston and New Orleans, of Madras and Bombay and Calcutta, drink at my well. In the morning, I bathe my intellect in the stupendous and cosmogonal philosophy of Bhagavad-gita. Years of the gods have elapsed, and in comparison with which our modern world and its literature seem puny and trivial. And I doubt if that philosophy is not to be referred to a previous state of existence, so remote is its sublimity from our conceptions. I lay down the book, the Bhagavad-gita, and go to my well for water, and lo, there I meet the servant of the Brahman, priest of Brahma and Vishnu and Indra, who still sits in his temple on the Ganges, reading the Vedas, or dwells at the root of a tree with his crust and water jug. I meet his servant, come to draw water for his master, and our buckets, as it were, grate together in the same well. The pure Walden water is mixed with the sacred water of the Ganges. With favoring winds, it is wafted past the sights of the fabulous islands of Atlantis and Hesperides, makes the Periplus of Hanau, and floating by Ternate and Tidore in the mouth of the Persian Gulf, melts in the tropic gales of the Indian Sea, and is landed in ports of which Alexander only heard the name. Now, that's a very different kind of heat training than the other men did. Now, skipping the poetry in A Man of War, which is a shame, I think I know there must be quite a few poets out here. Melville wrote a very comic sketch of writing and publishing poetry in a warship in the 1940s. We'll save that for another occasion, perhaps. The next thing here is more or less in honor of my office mate, Roger Bowen, who is from Falmouth, England, where Pendennis Castle is, and where this actually takes place. And this is from Herman Melville's historical novel called Israel Potter, an American, his 40 years exile. And this is a novel about the American Revolution. And Israel Potter, in this scene, is only an observer, or, as it were, a listener. And the scene is really, as you'll see, about another man who characterizes himself as a Christian, a gentleman, and an American. I had an uncle, his name was Buck, who I went hunting with when I was a boy. And ever since those days, I've always appreciated a man who can swear well, because he had some of the most marvelous round things, say, like you red-whiskered Presbyterian leather-headed son of a bitch. And this passage has been selected because Ethan Allen possesses that talent in spades. It gets a little loud sometimes, so... Next day was Sunday, and about noon, Israel, with others, was allowed to go ashore from the ship for a stroll. The town was quiet. Seeing nothing very interesting there, he passed out alone into the fields along shore, and presently found himself climbing a cliff whereon stood Pendennis Castle. As he stepped upon the short, crisp lawn under its walls, he started at a violent sound from within, as of the roar of some tormented lion. Soon the sound became articulated, and he heard the following words bayed out with an amazing vigor: "Brag no more, old England. Consider you are but an outland. Order back your broken battalion home, and repent in ashes. Long enough have your hired Tories across the sea forgotten the Lord their God, and bowed down and Niphausen the Hessian. Hands off, you red-skinned jackal wearing the king's plate, as I do. I have treasures of wrath against you, British." Then came a clanking as of a chain. Many vengeful sounds, all confusedly together, were struggling. Then again, the voice: "Ye brought me out here from my dungeon to this green affronting yon Sabbath sun to see how a rebel looks, but I show you how a true gentleman and Christian can conduct an adversity back, dog. Respect a gentleman and a Christian, though he be in rags and smell of bilge water." And filled with astonishment at these words, which came from over a massive wall enclosing what seemed an open parade space, Israel pressed forward and soon came to a black archway leading far within underneath the grassy track, through a tower, like two boar's tusks. Two sentries stood on guard at either side of the open jaws of the arch. Scrutinizing our adventurer a moment, they signed him permission to enter. Arrived at the end of the archway where the sun shone, Israel stood transfixed at the scene, like some baited bring crouched the Patagonian-looking captive, handcuffed as before, the grass of the green trampled and gored up all around him, both by his own movements and those of the people around. Except some soldiers and sailors, these scenes, mostly townspeople, collected there out of curiosity. The stranger was outlandishly arrayed in the sorry remains of a half-Indian, half-Canadian sort of a dress, consisting of a fawn-skin jacket, the fur outside and hanging in ragged cuffs, a half-rotten, bark-like belt of wampum, aged breeches of sagacity, the darned worsted soft stockings in the knee, to the knee, old moccasins riddled with holes, their metal tags yellow with saltwater rust, a faded red woolen bonnet not unlike a Russian nightcap or a portentous and sanguine full moon, all soiled and stuck with, along and about with bits of half-rotted straw. He seemed just broken from the dead leases in David's outlawed cave of Doolin, unshaved, beard hair matted, and profuse as a cornfield beaten down by hailstorms. His whole marred aspect was that of some wild beast, but of a royal sort, and unsubdued by the cage. "Aye, stare, stare, though, but last night dragged out of a ship's hold like a smutty pierce,
And this morning, out of your littered barracks here like a murderer, for all that, you may well stare at Ethan Ticonderoga Allen, the unconquered soldier. You son of a bitches, you Turks never saw a Christian before. Stare on, I am he who, when your Lord Howe wanted to bribe a patriot to fall down and worship him by an offer of a major generalship and 5,000 acres of choice land in old Vermont. Ha! 3 times 3 for glorious old Vermont and my Green Mountain boys. Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah! I am he, I say, who answered your Lord Howe, you offer our land. You are like the devil in Scripture offering all the kingdoms of the world, you bastard. You had not a corner lot on earth. Here on. Look, you rebel, this is the British are talking to him. Look, you rebel, you had best heed how you talk against General Lord Howe. Here said a thin, waft-waisted, epauletted officer of the castle, coming near and flourishing his sword like a schoolmaster's ferule. General Lord Howe, heed how I talk of that toad-hearted, king's lick spittle of a scarlet poltroon, the vilest wriggler in God's wormhole below. I tell you the herds of red-haired devils are impatiently snorting to ladle Lord Howe, with all his gang, you included, into the seamless syrups of Tophet's flames. At this blast, the wasp-waisted officer was blown backwards as from the sudden burst head of a steam boiler. Staggering away with snapped spine, he muttered something about it being beneath his dignity to bandy words further with a low-lived rebel. Come, Colonel Allen, here said a mild-looking man, clerical undress. Respect the day better than to talk thus of what lies beyond. For you to die this hour, or what is more probable, be hanged next week at Tower Wharf, you know not what might become in eternity of yourself. Reverend sir, with a mocking bow, when not better employed braiding my beard, I have a little dabbled in your theology. And let me tell you, reverend sir, that as to the world of spirits, of which you hint, though I know nothing of the mode or manner of the world, no more than do you, yet I expect, when I shall arrive there, to be treated as well as any other gentleman of my merit, that is to say, far better than you British know how to treat an American officer and meek-hearted Christian captured in honorable war. Christ, everyone tells me, as you yourself just breathed, and as crossing the sea every billow dimmed into my ear, that I, Ethan Allen, am to be hung like a thief. If I am, the great Jehovah and Continental Congress shall avenge me, while I, for my part, shall show you even on the tree how a Christian gentleman can die. Meantime, sir, if you are the clergyman you look, act out your conciliatory function by getting an unfortunate Christian gentleman about to die a bowl of punch. This next one is also invective, but of a very, very different kind. This is written by Melville's friend Nathaniel Hawthorne in his book, known to all of you, The Scarlet Letter. It's from a little essay that he called The Custom House. And he was very mad because he had lost a cushy job at the Custom House and when the political party changed in the election. And he also expresses in this essay, besides his spleen towards his polite spleen towards the politics of his time and the kind of people that hold office, he expressed a great deal of bitterness towards his hometown of Salem and said how much he hated being the great-great-grandson of one of the founding fathers of that place. And in the Custom House sketch, we find this passage, which I think is kind of a model for putting the knife in slowly and steadily rather than taking an axe to somebody. And the father of the Custom House, the patriarch, not only of this little squad of officials, but I am bold to say of the respectable body of tide waiters all over the United States, was a certain permanent inspector. This inspector, when I first knew him, was a man of 80 years or thereabouts, and certainly one of the most wonderful specimens of him that you would be likely to discover in a lifetime search.
With his florid cheeks, his compact figure, smartly arrayed in a bright and buttoned blue coat, his brisk and vigorous step, and his hale and hearty aspect, altogether he seemed, not young indeed, but a kind of new contrivance of Mother Nature in the shape of a man whom age and infirmity had no business to touch. His voice and laugh, which perpetually re-echoed through the custom house, had nothing of the tremulous quaver and cackle of an old man's utterance. They came strutting out of his lungs like the crow of a cock or the blast of a clarion. Looking at him merely as an animal, and there was very little else to look at, he was the most satisfactory object, from the thorough helpfulness and wholesomeness of his system and his capacity at his extreme age to enjoy all, or nearly all, of the delights which he had ever aimed at or conceived of. The careless security of his life in the custom house, on a regular income and with but slight and infrequent apprehensions of removal, had no doubt contributed to make time pass over him. The original and more potent causes, however, lay in the rare perfection of his animal nature, the moderate proportion of intellect, and the very trifling admixture of moral and spiritual ingredients. These latter qualities, indeed, being in barely enough measure to keep the old gentleman from walking on all fours. He possessed no power of thought, no depth of feeling, no troublesome sensibilities, nothing in short, but a few commonplace instincts, which, aided by the cheerful temper which grew inevitably out of his physical well-being, did duty very respectably and in general acceptance in lieu of a heart. He had been the husband of three wives, all long since dead, the father of 20 children, most of whom at every age of childhood or maturity had likewise returned to the dust. And here one would suppose, might have been sorrow enough to imbue the sunniest disposition through and through with a sable tinge. Not so with our old inspector. One brief sigh sufficed to carry off the entire burden of these dismal truths. The next moment, he was ready for sport as any unbreached infant, far readier than the collector's junior clerk, who at 19 years was much the older and graver of the two. One point in which he had vastly the advantage over his four-footed brethren was his ability to recollect the good dinners which it had been no small portion of the happiness of his life to eat. His gourmandism was a highly agreeable trait, and to hear him talk of roast meat was as appetizing as a pickle or an oyster. As he possessed no higher attribute and neither sacrificed nor vitiated any spiritual endowment by devoting all of his energies and ingenuity to subserve the delight and profit of his maw, it was always pleasing and satisfying for me to hear him expatiate on fish, poultry, and butcher's meat, and the most eligible methods of preparing them to the table. His reminiscences of good cheer, however ancient the date of the actual banquet, seemed to bring the savor of pig or turkey under one's very nostrils. There were flavors on his that had lingered there not less than 60 or 70 years, and were still apparently as fresh as that of the mutton chop which he had just devoured for his breakfast. I have heard him smack his lips over dinners, every guest of which, except himself, had long been food for worms. It was marvelous to observe how the ghosts of bygone meals were continually rising up before him, not in anger or retribution, but as if grateful for his former appreciation, and seeking to reduplicate an endless series of enjoyments, at once shadowy and sensual. A tenderloin of beef, a hind quarter of veal, a spare rib of pork, a particular chicken, or a remarkably praiseworthy turkey, which had perhaps adorned his board in the days of the elder Adams, would be remembered, while all the subsequent experience of our race and all the events that brightened or darkened his individual career had gone over him with as little permanent effect as the passing breeze. The chief tragic event of the old man's life, so far as I could judge, was his mishap with a certain goose, which lived and died some 20 or 40 years ago, a goose of most promising figure, but which at table proved so inveterately tough that the carving knife would make no impression on its carcass, and it had to be divided with an axe and a handsaw. Now, that essay, the custom house, created a big turmoil, you know, when people read it. I mean, this is written about an actual living man. Hawthorne wrote a little preface to the second edition of Scarlet Letter, and it goes like this, very short. And I think for exquisite, politeness and scorn, this thing takes a prize. much to the author's surprise, and if he may say so without additional offense, considerably to his amusement, he finds that his sketch of official life, introductory to the Scarlet Letter, has created an unprecedented excitement in the respectable community immediately around him. He could hardly have been more violent, indeed, had he burned down the custom house and quenched its last smoking ember in the blood of a certain venerable personage against whom he was supposed to cherish a particular malevolence. As the public disapprobation would weigh very heavily on him were he conscious of deserving it, the author begs leave to say that he has carefully read over the introductory pages with a purpose to alter or expunge whatever might be found amiss, and to make the best reparation in his power for the atrocities of which he has been adjudged guilty. But it appears to him that the only remarkable features of the sketch are its frank and genuine good humor and the general accuracy with which he has conveyed his sincere impression of the characters therein described. As to enmity or ill feeling of any kind, personal or political, he utterly disclaims such motives. The sketch might perhaps have been wholly admitted without any loss to public or detriment to the book, but having undertaken to write it, he conceives that it could not have been done in a better or a kindlier spirit, nor so far as his abilities avail with a livelier effect of truth. The author is constrained, therefore, to republish this introductory sketch without the change of a word. Now, the next selection is a series of short things, all with one theme, the Civil War, and they come from what I think of as a very fine book, one of the very truly human books that I've ever read, Walt Whitman's autobiography called Specimen Days. And it tells about the war in chronological order. He uses one word in here, success, which was a slang term in the 1850s for someone who was a Southerner. Success with someone from the seceding state. Some of these dates, some of them have titles, and when they do have dates and titles, I'll read those. Where they don't, I just pause between them. The start of the war. Even after the bombardment of Sumter, the gravity of the revolt and the power and will of the slave states for strong and continued military resistance to national authority were not at all realized at the North except by a few. I remember that a couple of companies of the 13th Brooklyn Regiment who rounded out at the city armory and started bench as 30 days men were all provided with pieces of rope conspicuously tied to their musket barrels with which to bring back each man a prisoner from the audacious South to be led in a noose on our men's early and triumphant return. All this sort of feeling was destined to be arrested and reversed by a terrible shock, the Battle of First Bull Run. Certainly, as we now know, it's one of the most singular fights on record. All battles and their results are far more matters of accident than is generally thought, but this one was thoroughly throughout a casualty of chance. Each side supposed to be the last moment. One had, in point of fact, just the same right to be routed as the other. By a fiction or a series of fictions, the national forces at the last moment exploded in a panic and fled from the field. The defeated troops commenced pouring into Washington over the Long Bridge at daylight on Monday, 22nd of July, day drizzling all throughout with rain. The men appear at first sparsely and shamefaced enough, then thicker in the streets of Washington, appear in Pennsylvania Avenue and on the steps and basements of entrances. They come along in disorderly mobs, some in squads, stragglers, companies, occasionally a rare regiment in perfect order with its officers, some gaps, dead, the true braves, marching in silence with lowered faces, stern, weary to sinking, all black and dirty, but every man with his musket and stepping alive, the few are the exceptions. Sidewalks of Pennsylvania Avenue, 14th Street, and so on, crowded, jammed with citizens, darkies, clerks, everybody, lookers-on, women in the windows, curious from faces, as those swarms of dirt-covered returned soldiers there, will they never end, move by. But nothing said, no comment. Half our lookers-on suspect of the most venomous kind. They say nothing, but the devil snickers in their faces. During the forenoon, Washington gets all over motley with these defeated soldiers, queer-looking objects, strange eyes and faces drenched. The steady rain drizzles on all day, and fearfully worn, hungry, haggard, blistered in the feet. good people, but not over many either, hurry up something for their grub. They put wash kettles on the fire for soup, for coffee. They set tables on the sidewalk. Wagon loads of bread are purchased swiftly and cut into stout chunks. Amid the deep excitement, crowds, emotion, and desperate eagerness, it seems strange to see many, very many, of the soldiers sleeping in the midst of all, sleeping soundly. They drop down anywhere, on the steps of houses, up close by the fences, on the sidewalk, aside on some vacant lot, and deeply sleep. Meantime in Washington, among the great persons and their entourage, a mixture of awful consternation, uncertainty, rage, shame, helplessness, and stupefying disappointment. The worst is not only imminent, but already here. In a few hours, perhaps before the next meal, the success generals with their victorious hordes will be upon us. The dream of humanity, the vaunted union we thought so strong, so impregnable, lo, it seems already smashed like a china plate. One bitter, bitter hour, perhaps proud America will never again know such an hour. She must pack and fly, no time to spare. Those white palaces, the dome-crowned capital there on the hill, so stately over the trees, shall they be left or destroyed first? For it is certain that the talk among certain of the magnates and officers and clerks and officials everywhere for 24 hours in and around Washington after Bull Run was loud and undisguised for yielding out and out and substituting the Southern rule and Lincoln promptly abdicating and departing. If the success officers and forces had immediately followed and by a bold Napoleonic movement had entered Washington the first day or even the second, they could have had things their own way and a powerful faction north to back them. But the hour, the day, the night passed, and whatever returns, an hour, a day, a night like that, can never return again. The president recovered himself, began that very night sternly, rapidly set about the task of reorganizing his forces and placing himself in positions for future and surer work. If there was nothing else of Abraham Lincoln for history to stamp him with, it is enough to send him with this wreath to the memory of all future times that he endured that hour, that day, bitterer than gall, indeed, a crucifixion day, that it did not conquer him, that he unflinchingly stemmed it and resolved to lift himself and the Union out of it. Down at the front, Falmouth, Virginia, opposite Fredericksburg, December 21st, 1862. Begin my visits among the camp hospitals in the Army of the Potomac, spend a good part of the day in a large brick mansion on the banks of the Rappahannock, used as a hospital since the battle. Seems to have received only the worst cases, outdoors at the foot of a tree within 10 yards of the front of the house. I noticed a heap of amputated feet, legs, arms, hands, and so forth, a full wagon load for a one-horse cart. Several dead bodies lie near, each covered with its brown woolen blanket. In the dooryard towards the river are fresh graves, most of them officers, their names on pieces of barrel staves with broken boards stuck in the dirt. A success grave. The grand soldiers are not comprised in those of one side any more than the other. At the War Department a few days ago, I witnessed the presentation of captured flags of to the Secretary of War. Among others, a soldier named Gant of 104th Ohio Volunteers presented a battle flag, which one of the officers stated to me was borne to the mouth of our cannon and planted there by a boy but 17 years of age, who actually endeavored to stop the muzzle of the gun with fence rails. He was killed in the effort. Abraham Lincoln. I see the president almost every day as I happen to live where he passes to or from his lodgings out of town. He never sleeps at the White House during the hot season, but has quarters at a healthy location some 3 miles north of the city, the Soldiers' Home, a United States military establishment. I saw him this morning about 8:30, coming into business, riding on Vermont Avenue near L Street. He always has a company of 25 or 30 cavalry with sabers drawn and held upright over their shoulders. They say this guard was against his personal wish, but he let his counselors have their way. The party makes no great show in uniform or horses. Mr. Lincoln on the saddle generally rides a good-sized, easy-going gray horse who's dressed in plain black, somewhat rusty and dusty, wears a black stiff hat, and looks about as ordinary in attire and so on as the commonest man. A lieutenant with yellow straps rides at his left, and following behind two by two come the cavalrymen in their yellow-striped jackets. They are generally going at a slow trot, as that is the pace set them by the one they wait upon. The sabers and accoutrements clank, and the entire unornamental cortege as it trots toward Lafayette Square arouses no sensation. Only some curious strangers stop and gaze. I see very plainly Abraham Lincoln's dark brown face with the deep cut lines, the eyes, always to me with a deep latent sadness in the expression. We have got so that we exchange bows, and very cordial ones. Sometimes the president goes and comes in an open barouche. The cavalry always accompany him with drawn sabers. Often I notice as he goes out evenings and sometimes in the morning when he returns early, he turns off and halts at the large and handsome residence of the Secretary of War on K Street and holds conference there. If in his barouche, I can see him from my window, and he does not alight, but sits in his Mrs. Stanton comes out to attend him. Sometimes one of his sons, a boy of 10 or 12, accompany him, riding on his right on a pony. Some specimen cases. June 18th. In one of the hospitals, I find Thomas Haley, Company N, 4th New York Cavalry, a regular Irish boy, a fine specimen of youthful physical manliness, came over to this country from Ireland to enlist. He has not a single friend or acquaintance here. The sleeping soundly at this moment, but it is a sleep of death. He has a bullet hole straight through the lungs. JTL of Company F, 9th New Hampshire, lies in bed 37, Ward I. He's very fond of tobacco. I furnished him some, also with a little money. He had gangrene of the feet. It's a pretty bad case, but surely will lose 3 toes. He's a regular specimen of an old-fashioned, rude-hearted New England countryman. Bed 3, Ward E, Armory, has a great hankering for pickles, something pungent. After consulting the doctor, I gave him a small bottle of horseradish, also some apples, also a book. Some of the nurses are excellent. The woman nurse in this ward I like very much, Mrs. Wright. A year afterwards, I found her in Mansion House Hospital, Alexandria. She is a perfect nurse. In one bed, a young man, Marcus Small, Company K, 7th Maine, sick with dysentery and typhoid fever. I talk with him often. He thinks he will die. Looks like it, indeed. I write a letter from him home to East Livermore, Maine. I let him talk to me a little, but not much, and advise him to keep very quiet, do most of the talking myself. Stay quite a while with him as he holds on to my hand. Talk to him in a cheering but slow, low and measured manner. Talk about his furlough and going home as soon as he is able to travel. And this afternoon I spent a long time with Oscar F. Wilbur, Company G, 154th, New York, low with chronic diarrhea and a bad wound also. He asked me to read him a chapter in the New Testament. I complied and asked him what I should read. He said, make your own choice. I opened at the close of one of the first books of the evangelist and read the chapters describing the latter hours of Christ and the scenes of the crucifixion. Poor, wasted young man asked me to read the following chapter also, how Christ rose again. I read very slowly for Oscar with feeble. It pleased him very much, yet the tears were in his eyes. He asked me if I enjoyed religion. I said, perhaps not, my dear, in the way you mean, and yet maybe it is the same thing. He said, it is my chief reliance. He talked of death and said he did not fear it. I said, why, Oscar, don't you think you'll get well? He said, I may, but it's not probable. He spoke calmly of his condition. The wound was very bad. It discharged much. Then the diarrhea had prostrated him, and I felt that he was even then the same as dying. He behaved very manly and affectionate. The kiss I gave him as I was about leaving, he returned fourfold. He gave his mother's address, Mrs. Sally B. Wilbur, Allegheny Post Office, Cattaraugus County, New York. I had several such interviews with him. He died a few days after the one just described. My preparation is for visits. In my visits to the hospitals, it was in the simple matter of personal presence and emanating ordinary cheer and magnetism that I succeeded and helped more than by medical nursing or delicacies or gifts of money or anything else. During the war, I possessed the perfection of physical health. My habit, when practicable, was to prepare for starting out on one of these daily or nightly tours of from a couple to 4 or 5 hours by fortifying myself with previous rest, the bath, clean clothes, a good meal, and as cheerful an appearance as possible. A silent night ramble, October 20th. Tonight, after leaving the hospital at 10 o'clock, I had been on self-imposed duty some 5 hours, pretty closely confined. I wandered a long time around Washington. The night was very sweet, very clear, sufficiently cool, a voluptuous half moon, slightly golden, the space near it of a transparent blue-gray tinge. I walked up Pennsylvania Avenue and then to 7th Street and a long while along by the office Somehow it looked rebukefully strong, majestic there in the delicate moonlight. The sky, the planets, the constellations, all so bright, so calm, so expressively silent, so soothing after those hospital scenes. I wandered to and fro till the moist moon set long after midnight. A glimpse of war's hell scene. After the battles at Columbia, Tennessee, where we repulsed about a score of vehement rebel charges, they left a great many wounded on the ground, mostly within our range. Whenever one of these wounded attempted to move away by any means, generally by crawling off, our men, without exception, brought them down by a bullet. They let none crawl away, no matter what his condition. In one of the late movements of our troops in the valley near Upperville, I think, a strong force of Mosby's mounted guerrillas attacked a chain of wounded and the guard of cavalry convoying them. The ambulances contained about 60 wounded, quite a number of them officers of rank. The rebels were in strength, and the captain and the sparkle guard, after a short snap, were effectively accomplished. No sooner had our men surrendered, the rebels instantly commenced robbing the train and murdering their prisoners, even the wounded. Here is the scene, or a sample of it, 10 minutes after. Among the wounded men in the ambulances were one, a lieutenant of regulars, and another of higher rank. These two were dragged out on the ground on their backs and were now surrounded by the guerrillas, a demonic crowd, each member of which was stabbing them in different parts of their bodies. One of the officers had his feet pinned firmly to the ground by a bayonet stuck through them and thrust into the ground. These two officers, as afterwards found on examination, had received about 20 such thrusts, some of them through the mouth, face, etc. The wounded had all been dragged to give a better chance also for plunder out of the wagon. Some had been effectually dispatched, and their bodies were lying there lifeless and bloody. Others, not yet dead but horribly mutilated, were moaning or groaning. Of our men who surrendered, most had been thus maimed or slaughtered. At this instant, a force of our cavalry, who had been following the train at some interval, suddenly charged the section. All been dragged to give a better chance also for plunder out of the wagon. Some had been effectually dispatched, and their bodies were lying there lifeless and bloody. Others, not yet dead but horribly mutilated, were moaning or groaning. Of our men who surrendered, most had been thus maimed or slaughtered. At this instant, a force of our cavalry, who had been following the train at some interval, suddenly charged upon the suspect captors, who proceeded at once to make the best escape they could. Most of them got away, but we gobbled 2 officers and 17 men in the very act just described. The sight was one which admitted of little discussion, as may be imagined. The 17 captured men and 2 officers were put under guard for the night, but it was decided there and then that they should die. The next morning, the 2 officers were taken in the town, separate places, put in the center of the street and shot. The 17 men were taken out to open ground, a little to one side. They were placed in a hollow half encompassed by 2 of our cavalry regiments, one of which regiments had 3 days before found the bloody corpses of 3 of their men hamstrung and hung up by the heels to limbs of trees by Mosby's guerrillas. And the other had not long before had 12 men, after surrendering, shot and then hung by the neck to limbs of trees, and jeering inscriptions pinned to the breast of one of the corpses who had been a sergeant. Those 3 and those 12 had been found, I say, by these environing regiments. Now, with revolvers, they formed the grim cordon of the 17 prisoners. The latter were placed in the midst of the hollow square, unfastened, and the ironical remarks made to them that they were now to be given a chance to themselves. A few ran for it, but what use? From every side, the deadly pills came. In a few minutes, the 17 corpses strewed the hollow square. I was curious to know whether some of the Union soldiers, some one or two of the, at least the youngsters, did not abstain from shooting on the helpless men. Not one. There was no exultation, very little said, yet every man contributed his shot. The Capitol by Gaslight. Tonight I have been wondering a while in the Capitol building, which is all lit up. The illuminated rotunda looks fine. I like to stand aside and look a long, long while up at the dome. It comforts me somehow. The House and Senate were both in session till very late. I looked in upon them, but only a few moments. They were hard at work on tax and appropriation bills. I wandered through the long and rich corridors and apartments under the Senate, an old habit of mine, former winters, and now more satisfactory than ever. Not many persons down there, occasionally a flitting figure in the distance. As I came out of the Capitol, I heard slow and clear the deliberate notes of a bugle coming out of the silence, sounding so good through the night's mystery. No hurry, but firm and faithful, floating along, rising, falling leisurely, with here and there a long note. The bugle, well played, sounding tattoo in one of the army hospitals near here, where the wounded, some of them personally dear to me, are lying in their cots. And many a sick boy come down to the war from Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, and the rest. Lincoln's Inauguration Ball, March 6, 1865. I had been up to look at the dance and supper rooms for the inauguration ball at the patent office, and I could not help thinking what a different scene they presented to my view a while since, filled with the crowded mass of the worst wounded of the war brought in from the Second Battle of Bull Run, Antietam, and Fredericksburg. Tonight, beautiful women, perfumes, the violin sweetness, the polka and the ball. Then, the amputation, the blue face, the groan, the glassy eye, the dying, the clotted rag, the odor of wounds and blood, and many a mother's son amid strangers passing away, untended there. For the crowd of the badly hurt was great, and much for nurse to do, and much for surgeon. The description of the end of the war. When Sherman's armies, long after they left Atlanta, were marching through South and North Carolina after leaving Savannah, the news of Lee's capitulation having been received, the men never moved a mile without, from some part of the line, sending up continued inspiriting shouts. At intervals all day long sounded out the wild music of those peculiar army cries. They would be commenced by one regiment or brigade, immediately taken up by others, and at length whole corps and armies would join in these wild, triumphant choruses. It was one of the characteristic expressions of the Western troops, and became a habit serving as a relief and outlet to the men, a vent for their feelings of victory, returning peace, and so on. Morning, noon, and afternoon, spontaneous, for occasion or without occasion, these huge, strange cries, differing from any other, echoing through the open air for many a mile, expressing youth, joy, wildness, irrepressible strength, and the ideas of advance and conquest, sounding along the swamps and uplands of the South, floating to the skies. This exuberance continued till the armies arrived at Raleigh. News of the president's murder was received. Then no more shouts or yells. A hush and silence pervaded all the army. May 21st, 1865, saw General Sheridan and his cavalry today. A strong, attractive sight. The men were mostly young, a few middle-aged. Superb-looking fellows, brown, spare, keen, with well-worn clothing, many with pieces of waterproof cloth around their shoulders hanging down. They dashed along pretty fast in wide, closed ranks, all spattered with mud, no holiday soldiers, brigade after brigade. I could have watched for a week. Sheridan stood on a balcony under a big tree, coolly smoking a cigar. His looks and manner impressed me favorably. May 22nd. Have been taking a walk along Pennsylvania Avenue and 7th Street North. The city is full of soldiers, running around loose, officers everywhere of all grades. All have the weather-beaten look of practical service. It is a sight I never tire of. All the armies are here now, or portions of them. For 2 days now, the broad spaces of Pennsylvania Avenue along to Treasury Hill, and so by detour around to the President's House, and so up to Georgetown and across the Aqueduct Bridge, have been alive with a magnificent sight. The returning army. In their wide ranks stretching clear across the avenue, I watched them march or ride along at a brisk pace through 2 whole days. Infantry, cavalry, artillery, some 200,000 men. And that's the end of the second day. I'm sorry that, for various reasons, there's not more poetry. I think the poetry is kind of responsive to reading, but I just kind of worked out that way for other considerations I've had in making these choices. But certainly we wouldn't want to make any representation of 19th century American literature without Emily Dickinson. And me, I know when I was an undergraduate and even a graduate student, I always had the idea that she's a repressed woman, you know, never touched a man or been touched by a man. And talk to people around corners and things like that, you know. These poems that she wrote about being a wife, I call her Epithalamian poems. And Epithalamian is, you know, a marriage poem, a poem about being married. And I think they're pretty remarkable poems, and I think they effectively dispel any, idea of her as somebody who was all bottled up inside. As far as experience is concerned. None of them, you know, have titles, so I'll just read in sequence. And then three other poems by her also on the subject, Plenty of Love. I'm white. I've finished that other state. I'm czar. Woman now. It's safer so. How odd the girl's life looks behind this soft eclipse. I think that Earth feels so to folks in heaven now. This being comfort, then that other kind is pain. But why compare? I am white. Stop there. In this poem, she uses the word cross. She's using another one of these epithelians. And cross, you know, means the marriage vow. I pledge my cross. There came a day at summer's full entirely for me. I thought that such were for the saints where resurrection be. The sun as common went abroad, the flowers accustomed to blue, as if no soul the solstice passed that maketh all things new. The time was scarce profaned by speech. The symbol of a word was needless, as at our sacrament, the wardrobe of our Lord. Each was to reach the sealed church, permitted to commune this time, lest we too awkward show at supper of the Lamb. The hours slid fast, as ours will, clutched tightly by greedy hands, so faces on sea decks look back, bound to opposing lands. And so, when all the time had leaped, without external sound, each bound the other's crucifix, we gave no other bond. Sufficient thought that we shall rise, depose at length the grave to that new marriage, justified through cavalry of love. Title divine is mine, the wife without the sign, acute degree conferred on me, empress of cavalry, royal all but the crown, posed. Without the swoon God sends us women, when you hold garnet to garnet, gold to gold, born, bridled, shrouded in a day, cry victory. My husband, women say, stroking the melody, is this the way? Rearrange a wife's affection. When they dislocate my brain, amputate my freckled bosom, make me bearded like a man, bless my spirit in thy fastness, bless my unacknowledged clay, 7 years of troth have taught thee more than wifehood ever may. Love that never leaked its socket, trust entrenched in narrow pain, constancy through fire awarded, anguish bare of anodyne, burden, born so far triumphant, none suspects me of the crown, for I wear the thorn till sun, then my diadem put on. Big my secret, but it's bandied. It will never get away till the day its wearer, keeper, leads it to the grave to be. Now, this is one of her, this is not an epithelian poem, in which the metaphor of wife is the principal motif. These are just simple lessons. This person has a typical tone of hers, a kind of wittiness, a kind of almost playful mockingness. Heart, we will forget him, you and I, tonight. You may forget the warmth he gave, I will forget the light. When you have done, pray tell me, then I may straight begin. Haste, lest while you're lagging, I remember him. Now, this one here uses two words also that were not part of my vocabulary, so it may not be part of yours, pandemity. They're both kinds of cloth. Plush is a deep piled cloth, and it has, I think, the net connection in the way she uses it, a definite sexual imagery to it, since you can stick things down into pile. And dimity is a sheer, thin, vaporous kind of cotton cloth. I noticed the scorn for women, a certain kind of woman in this poem.
What soft, cherubic creatures these gentle women are, one would as soon assault a plush or violate a star. Such dimity convictions, a horror so refined, a feckled human nature, a deity, a change, it's such a common glory, a fisherman's degree, redemption, brittle lady, be so ashamed of thee. And this last one, I think in the rhythm of the poem, bespeaks her experience of actual love. The first line of it is the word wild night. Wild nights were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury, futile the winds to a heart in port, done with a compass, done with the chart. Rowing in Eden, ah, the sea, might I but moor the night in thee. The last selection I've got here is from an author that is also, those poems, by the way, were written during the same year that the Civil War was being fought. Kind of an amazing thing. The Civil War might have taken place on another planet as far as anybody was concerned. And last selection is from Mark Twain's work, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And it's one of the arguments that, several arguments that Jim and Huck have on their trip down the river on the raft. And this one concerns the question of why a Frenchman can't talk like a man. And Huck has gotten hold of a book, and he's not a bookie person, you know, but he's telling Jim all about the lives of kings and dukes, of which he knows not a damn thing, really, but he's full of the authority of having written this book. I read considerable to Jim about kings and dukes and earls and such, and how gaudy they dressed, and how much style they put on, and called each other your majesty and your grace and your lordship and so on, instead of mister. And Jim's eyes bugged out, and he was interested. He says, I didn't know there was so many of them. I ain't heard about none of them, scarcely, but old King Solomon, unless you count them kings that's in the pack of cards. How much do a king get? Get, I says, why, they get $1,000 a month. They can have just as much as they want. Everything belongs to them. Ain't that gay? And what they got to do, huh? They don't do nothing. Why, how you talk, they just sit around. No, is that so? Of course it is. They just sit around. Except maybe when there's a war, then they go to the war. But other times, they're just lazy around. I went to talking about other kings and told about Louis XVI that got his head cut off in France a long time ago, and about his little boy, the dolphin, and that would have been a king, but they took and shut him up in jail, and some say he died there. Poor little chap, Jim said. But some says he got out and got away and come to America. That's good, but he'll be pretty lonesome here. There ain't no kings here, is there, Huck? No. Then he can't get no position. What he want to do? Well, I don't know. Some of them get on the police, and some of them learn people to talk French. Why, how don't the French people talk the same way we do? No, Jim. You couldn't understand a word they said, not a single word. Well, now, Buster, how did that come? I don't know, but it's so. I got some of their jabber out of a book. Suppose a man was to come to you and say, Polly, Boo, Franzy? What would you think? I wouldn't think nothing. I'd take and bust him over the head. That is, if he weren't white. I wouldn't allow no nigger to talk to me like that. Shucks, it ain't calling you anything. It's only saying you know how to talk French. Well, then why can't he say it? Why, he is a saying it. That's a Frenchman's way of saying it. What a blame ridiculous way, and I don't want to hear no more about it. There ain't no sense in it. Look here, Jim. Does a cat talk like we do? No, a cat don't. Well, there's a cow. No, a cow don't nutter. Does a cat talk like a cow or a cow talk like a cat? No, they don't. It's natural and right for them to talk different from each other, ain't it? Of course. And ain't it natural and right for a cat and a cow to talk different from us? Why, most surely it is. Well, then, why is it natural and right for a Frenchman to talk different from us? You answer me that. Is a cat a man, Huck? No,
Well, then, there ain't no sense in a cat talking like a man. Is a cow a man? Or is a cow a cat? No, she ain't either of them. Well, then, she ain't got no business to talk like either one of them or the other. Is a Frenchman a man? Yes. Well, then, dad blame it, why don't he talk like a man? You answer me that.
I see it weren't no use wasting words. You can't learn a nigger to argue, so I quit. Thank you. Kind of medium long, and it's by Melville. It's not the thing, like something else. So it's from the same book, though. It's from White Gadget. And if any of you have to leave, want to leave, feel like leaving, please don't be shy about it. I know this is a forced encore. After 100 years of hearing only readings of British poetry and literature, I think we deserve an extra inning here. Right? This is chapter 61 of White Jacket. The title of the chapter is The Surgeon of the Fleet. Cadwallader Cuticle, M.D., an honorary member of the most distinguished colleges of surgeons both in Europe and America, was our surgeon of the fleet. Nor was he at all blind to the dignity of his position, to which, indeed, he was rendered peculiarly competent if the reputation he enjoyed was deserved. He had the name of being the foremost surgeon in the Navy, a gentleman of remarkable science and a veteran practitioner. He was a small, withered man, nearly, perhaps, 2 years of age. His chest was shallow, his shoulders bent, his pantaloons hung round skeleton legs, and his face was singularly attenuated. In truth, the corporal vitality of this man seemed in a good degree to have died out of him. He walked abroad, a curious patchwork of life and death, with a wig, one glass eye, and a set of false teeth. While his voice was husky and thick, but his mind seemed as undebilitated as in his youth, it shone out of his remaining eye with basilic brilliancy. Like most old physicians and surgeons who have seen much service and have been promoted to high official place for their scientific attainments, this Cuticle was an enthusiast in his calling. In private, he had once been heard to say confidentially that he would rather cut off a man's arm than dismember the wing of the most delicate pheasant. In particular, the Department of Morbid Anatomy was his peculiar love, and in his stateroom below, he had a most unsightly collection of Parisian casts in plaster and wax representing all imaginable malformations of human members, both organic and induced by disease. Well knowing the enthusiasm of the surgeon for all specimens of morbid anatomy, some of the wardroom officers used to play upon his credulity, though in every case, Cuticle was not long in discovering their deception. Once, when they had had some sago pudding for dinner, and Cuticle had chance to be ashore, they made up a neat parcel of this bluish-white, firm, jelly-like preparation and placed it in a tin box, carefully sealed with wax. They deposited it on the gun room table with a note purporting to come from an eminent physician in Rio connected with the Grand National Museum, begging leave to present the scientific Senhor Cuticle with the donor's compliments, an uncommonly fine specimen of a cancer. Descending to the wardroom, Cuticle spied the note, and no sooner read it than, clutching the case, he opened it and exclaimed, "Beautiful! Splendid! I have never seen a finer specimen of this most interesting disease." "What have you there, Surgeon Cuticle?" said a lieutenant, advancing. "Why, sir, look at it. Did you think more exquisite? Very exquisite indeed. Let me have a bit of it, will you, Cuticle? "Let you have a bit of it," shrieked the surgeon, starting back. "Let you have one of my limbs. I wouldn't mar so large a specimen for $100, but what can you want of it? You are not making collections." "I'm fond of the article," said the lieutenant. "It's a fine cold relish to bacon or ham. You know I was in New Zealand last cruise, Cuticle, and got into sad dissipation there among the cannibals. So let's have a bit, if it's only a mouthful." "Why, you infernal Fiji," shouted Cuticle, eyeing the other with a confounded expression. "You don't really mean to eat a piece of this cancer. Hand it to me and see whether I will not," was the reply. "In God's name, take it," cried the surgeon, putting the case into his hand, and then standing with his own uplifted. "Steward," cried the lieutenant, "the castor quick. I always use plenty of pepper with this dish, surgeon. It's oystery."
Ah, this is really delicious, he added, smacking his lips over a mouthful. Try it now, surgeon, and you'll never keep such a fine dish as this lying uneaten on your hands as a mere scientific curiosity. Cuticle's whole countenance changed, and slowly walking up to the table, he put his nose close to the tin case, then touched its contents with his finger and tasted it. Enough. Buttoning up his coat, in all the tremblings of an old man's rage, he burst from the wardroom and, calling for a boat, was not seen for 24 hours. Now I will quit.